Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 11th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have our Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. First, I'm going to review money and markets and some questions and ask Catherine more questions on precious metals with Franklin. There's no movie tonight. There's too much happening, and so I wanted extra time to cover money and markets. Very, very busy time. Our theme for the week is trade wars by every other name. If you go back and look at the history of the Great Depression, one of the things you'll find is if anything caused a real spiral down in the economy, it was the breakout of trade wars. After we came out of the Depression into World War II, we put together a framework between Bretton Woods and GATT to create a global structure for trade and cooperation. And so what we're watching now is the breakout of trade wars that in many respects are fiercer than the ones we saw in the Great Depression, but they're not breaking out the same way. Instead of legislatures passing laws that says Japanese cars can't come into the United States, or China passing a law with respect to what mining companies can and cannot do. Instead, we're seeing dirty tricks. We're watching regulatory and enforcement claim safety issues or bring criminal indictments, or we're watching smear campaigns in the marketplace. And literally, the trade wars are getting violent because as different companies and different blocks of the global economy are competing for more, you know, shrinking cash flows and shrinking market shares, the trade wars are turning violent. But you have to sort of look underneath the headlines because we're not being anywhere near as clear and overt about the trade wars. It's much more sneaky. And so I want to really focus this week on sort of what the trade wars behind a lot of the headlines. The number one most important dangerous trade war and powerful trade war to watch, I've covered on the blog, and there's a blog at the top of the a post at the top of the blog tonight. It's really about bank data. We have seen real bickering growing over the last year and a half between the United States and Europe and the European Union over the American access to the SWIFT system, which is a clearance system, a global clearance system, and we've seen Europe literally move the location of the data banks for European wire transfers out of the United States and into Switzerland. So if you ask me if Switzerland is safer than the United States, the European Union certainly thinks so. But this is depository not for money, but for the data about money, and it's important. Nicholas Negroponte, when he was head of the MIT Media Lab, once said, in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. And that's true because there is no tool more valuable for the game of economic warfare than the databases on bank wiring through the economy. It's the ultimate sort of insider data. Now, what came out in these various debates, and you can read about this on the blog, is that it turns out that the Americans have been accessing data on the SWIFT system illegally. And this is now front and center in the news, which is amazing. But today, the European Union voted against the U.S. having access to the European transfers. This is an extraordinary development, and it's part of what I call the promise software wars. And if you want to ever dig in and understand the sort of data games and illegal access to financial data, Promise Software is P-R-O-M-I-S. It's a whole other story, but this is part of the Promise Software wars, and this represents an extraordinary breakdown in the sort of financial cooperation within the financial system. So pay attention. Now, we've had a series of meetings, starting with the World Economic Forum in Davos, where I reported last week was reported that the elites were sort of beating up on the bankers. We had the central bankers meet in Australia through a meeting scheduled long ago by the Bank of International Settlements, and we had the G7 finance meet, ministers' meeting in Canada. And meantime, we have Congress, the Democrats, still talking about going forward with financial regulation. And what comes out of all these various conversations is tremendous frustration with the financial system, but not a clear vision of what to do and how to change it. What did come out of that whole process and discussion over the last week is a lot of PR. And we saw both UBS announce that they were clawing back deferred compensation to their leaders. We saw JP Morgan Chase announce a very downsized bonus for their CEO of $17 million, Goldman Sachs $9 million, very much downsized for their CEO. And then yesterday, to add insult to injury, we had Obama announce, let me just read it, President Barack Obama said he doesn't begrudge the $17 million bonus awarded to JP Morgan Chase CEO, $9 million to Goldman Sachs, noting that some athletes take home more money. The president, speaking in an interview, said in response to a question that while $17 million is an extraordinary amount of money for Main Street, there are some baseball players who are making more than that and don't get to the World Series either, so I'm shocked by that as well. I know both these guys. They're very savvy businessmen, Obama said in the interview yesterday. I like most of the American people, don't begrudge people success or wealth. This is part of the free market system. Well, to suggest that any profits at Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan Chase this and last year have anything to do with the free market is, of course, absurd, and most Americans know it. And I can only presume that the reason the president would have said something, which is clearly political suicide to say, is that was the price of getting these guys to scale back their bonuses dramatically, was to agree to give clear support for what they were doing from the Oval Office. Now, at the same time, in the marketplace, one of the things that's making it very difficult for any kind of agreement on financial regulation is the sovereign debt challenges that are overhanging. We saw tremendous pressure by speculators to sort of bust the bank in Greece and take down Greece, if you will. We saw Joe Stiglitz, who's acting as the financial advisor to Greece, screaming about speculators and saying, you know, this is kind of the thing that busted Asia in 97 and 98. I wouldn't be surprised if the same dirty tricks are going on. And so a lot of pressure on the euro and a run to the dollar. Franklin said to me earlier this week when I was talking about the rise in the dollar coming from the fears over European sovereign debt, he said, you know, everybody ran to the euro because they were trying to get it away from the wolf. So they went over the mountain and discovered there's a tiger there, and now they're running back. And what you're seeing literally is a race for safety around and around when, in fact, you know, safety can't be found until you start to build up the real economy and engage in the rule of law. The problem is those two things are breaking down. But there was a very, very intelligent comment on Seeking Alpha, one of the more popular financial blog spots, on the financial or sort of the sovereign debt problem in Europe versus America. And let me read it to you. The seven states to make my list are California, Florida, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, and New Jersey. He's talking about what states have the worst sovereign debt problems in this country. Each has a population of above 8 million people. Each has had to borrow more than $1 billion so far to pay claims out of their now bankrupt unemployment insurance fund. Also, each state currently registers broad unemployment above 15%, as indicated by the U6 measure for the states. And finally, each state is a large net importer of either oil, natural gas, electricity, or all three of these energy sources. Now, just as an aside, he's not including Pennsylvania, which last week announced that as part of their formal process to balance the budget, they were going to consider bankruptcy as an option within the budget committee. An astounding announcement that, given the problems going on with Greece, didn't get much attention in the marketplace. So the quote continues. My seven states of energy debt represent a full 35% of the total U.S. population. As with other U.S. states, they face looming policy clashes between protected state and city workers on one hand and the growing ranks of the private economies underemployed on the other. The recent circus at the L.A. City Council meeting was a nice foreshadowing that the days of unlimited borrowing by governments against future growth based on cheap energy is coming to an end. Washington can print up dollars and fund these states for years if it so chooses. But just as with the 70 million people in Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, those are the four European countries said to have the strongest debt problems right now. But just as with the 70 million people in Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, the 108 million people in these seven large states are probably facing even higher levels of unemployment as austerity measures finally slam into their cashless coffers and reduce their ability to borrow. So as you look at the sovereign debt challenges in Europe, just remember they're coming our way. One of the things that was very interesting, Joe Stiglitz, who I just mentioned is financial advisor to Greece, announced in response to Moody's, the rating agency's announcement that they were considering lowering the rating on the United States government, said that the notion of a default on U.S. federal debt was absurd since the federal government could just print money to pay off the debt. And I love Stiglitz for making it clear to the, you know, to the market just what was planned for the dollar. Interestingly enough, Rasmussen, the poll survey company, said as of a week and a half ago that 58% of Americans think the government has too much influence. Wait till they see what happens when the states try and balance their budgets. The ugliest trade war. Before I go into Japan, I just want to mention two other things. The New Mexico House, and this is up on the blog, has now voted. It's just the House. This hasn't been passed. Has voted to move deposits, all the state deposits, to local community banks and credit unions. The vote in the New Mexico House was 65-0. This is a very important point as the states go to balance the budget, because if you look at all the different things that a state can do to really create local employment, and what you'll see is, as you look at the cash flows, whether it's the state pension funds, whether it's the various cash reserves, whereas the various deposits, they're shipping an enormous amount of business to Wall Street and internationally. And they're the ones who are choosing to drain the economy. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether this New Mexico House vote catches on and whether it passes in New Mexico or starts to happen elsewhere. And I also wanted to mention the Senate is writing a job bill, which is really, you know, I hate to say it, is really nothing. The CBO just announced they estimate $13 billion is going to be the cost, and they estimate that it will produce 104,000 to 234,000 jobs, which if you look at the speed at which unemployment is growing is really nothing more than a tinker. Possibly the ugliest trade war this week was, I suspect, what happened with Toyota and Honda. I just watched a very interesting documentary. It's a biography of Ralph Nader, and it was a reminder to me of the difficulty various consumer groups have had to try and get the U.S. government to really act in a responsible manner related to auto safety. And yet what we see now that the United States government has a major equity position in General Motors, we're seeing the United States use the regulatory enforcement arms of the federal government to literally attack GM's strongest competitors, Toyota and Honda, over safety issues. And my guess is if we dig down far enough, what we're looking at is a trade war by another name. And of course, safety is one of the preferred ways of having those sneaky kind of wars. If you watch what happened to Toyota over the last 2 weeks, if you watch what happened to their stock price, the impact on their market share is quite extraordinary. We even had the Secretary of Transportation saying you ought to stop driving your cars right now. An extraordinary thing. Apparently he took it back. But you're literally seeing a very different approach to safety than we've normally seen from the U.S. government. And the fact that they now own the General Motors equity is very, very suspicious. Clearly, Ford stock is up. GM is private. It's no longer publicly traded. But you can bet their equity values are up as well. China, same thing. Frosty sort of behavior over U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. As a backdrop to this, it's not something that's widely understood in America, our market share of global arms sales is absolutely astonishing. It rose from over 40% to 70% during the 90s. And so we are very economically dependent on selling arms all around the world to friend and enemy alike. And after currency, it's certainly one of our most major exports. Now, we saw China turn around and do a couple of things. One is their sovereign wealth fund. So the Chinese military suggested that they start selling treasuries. That was only a suggestion. But we saw the China sovereign wealth fund announce that supposedly on an unrelated basis, it's going to sell all of its U.S. fixed income other than treasuries or Fannie Mae. This was positioned in the market as a move to quality based on what was going on with sovereign bond problems. I would say I think there's something else going on here, which is what it means is they're not going to buy corporate bonds. They've taken positions in corporate stocks. What they're saying is we're prepared to own equity in our competitors, but we're not prepared to finance our competitors with fixed income. So I think beneath there may be another trade war by another name. We also saw China announce that it was going to indict four Rio Tinto employees based on over negotiations on some mining issues. This is bringing criminal charges, including against one Australian employee. Again, another form of trade war. For executives who have to operate in that environment, a pretty sneaky one. Last thing I wanted to mention on the trade war front, we saw several weeks ago, and we talked about this earlier, a Swiss regulator announced that if the U.S. regulators continued to hold their positions regarding UBS, that literally the bank could go down. And as I said, after the Davos events, we saw UBS announce that it was going to claw back deferred compensation from its executives. I got came an email on Monday with the latest UBS research report that literally predicted glowing things for the U.S. stock market and capital markets this year, and it was so out of context to what was going on in the marketplace. You know, I said to myself, do you really want to depend on research from an institution which is doing everything it can to prevent the U.S. regulators from driving it out of business? Seems to me that there's a serious conflict of interest. Let's talk on the housing front. We now we see Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announce various programs to purchase delinquent loans. There's a history here that I want to make sure I point out to you. Traditionally, when the housing market busts, what happens is the banks sort of roll up their toxic mortgages and ship them in to the federal government. When I was FHA commissioner, it's what happened in 89-90, literally the bad loans being sold into or refinanced into FHA or Ginnie Mae. At this point, the toxic mortgage problem is much too big for just FHA, and they're literally putting it into Fannie and Freddie. The interesting thing about this is, as we've discussed last December, just a month and a half ago, the Treasury, right before Christmas, announced that they were, in essence, going to guarantee the net deficit of Freddie and Fannie. So now Freddie and Fannie have really a complete government guarantee, no matter how much money they lose, and that makes it free for the banks to shift all their toxic mortgages into it. So there's an enormous backdoor industry subsidy going on, and again, it's one of the many ways that the banking industry benefits, and another reason why the president calling this a free enterprise system really galls. One of the things Franklin pointed out to me during dinner is there's been a new announcement now from Citibank that they're inviting people with defaulted mortgages to stay in their home for 6 months and offering them $1,000 when they leave. It's just another sign of how sort of the extent of the real trouble in the housing market. All of these things are a challenge for the stock market, and that's what we've been watching all week. You have the debt overhang as a struggle and money rushing back and forth looking for a safe place to go in fixed income, and that causes greater volatility in the stock market. The other thing that causes greater volatility in the stock market is the outbreak of these sort of trade wars by another name. If you're Toyota and you can get hit overnight with these kinds of regulatory and enforcement struggles, then your political risk is going up and your cost of capital is going up. And so what we're watching is a wholesale increase in the cost of doing business for a lot of corporations. Now, the offset to all of this, an interesting article in Kiplinger saying, does the Supreme Court decision to allow corporations to basically spend money on campaigns, you know, sort of on the theory that this gives corporations the right of free speech, Kiplinger asked the question, will this advantage foreign corporations and give foreign influence, open the door to foreign influence on U.S. elections? Kiplinger says, not clear. I would say yes, clearly it would. And so, you know, you almost wonder if these trade wars are trying to protect the GM equity position or simply a fundraising technique for American officials who want to make sure Toyota ups the money flowing into campaigns. But whatever it is, the environment is getting dirtier and dirtier. Okay, our hero of the week, two heroes of the week. The first is the Crosby Mint Farm. If you've been following the story of the Crosby Mint Farm, the oldest operating mint farm, makes wonderful pure mint, had been foreclosed on and thrown out of the farm under very dirty circumstances. They've just announced today they got the farm back. It's an incredible story and one that shows remarkable faith and persistence by the Crosby family. You can read about it on the blog. We just put their announcement up. That's a one-farm situation on a much wider farm. The farmers and ranchers of America have done an incredible thing, and it's just so heartwarming. Again, up on the blog, they have beaten back the National Animal Identification System. We've literally seen I would say healthcare reform was really working towards chipping humans, but National Animal Identification System was literally going to require every farm animal in the country to be chipped and counted. And this is a great victory. It's the kind of victory we've seen in other areas where people really get together and decide to dig in. Franklin can give you the whole history on homeschooling. That's another one. But it's an incredible victory. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Democratic laws in Massachusetts helped there, because the Democrats now really have to think carefully about where they're going to go forward. And they continue to use up a lot of political capital trying to come up with a slimmed down health care bill, and they certainly can't afford to spend a lot of anger on that. The big question is, are they going to keep trying to go forward with the food safety bill, which is another trade war of just the big agribusiness against the little guys? It's passed the House last summer. It's still pending in the Senate, so we'll see what happens there. And sort of sympathy in this category to Michelle Obama, she has announced a real effort, sort of her priority effort as First Lady, is to go to work on child obesity. Child obesity is a very serious problem and a very important problem. I put up on the blog about a week or two ago a documentary called Killer at Large, which is about food policy and child obesity. A remarkable documentary that I recommend very strongly to you. And it's one that helps you sit back and see what the intentional federal policies are, literally, to destroy the health of children. It's extraordinary. My sympathy to Michelle Obama, because if you look at what she's proposing to do, it's some very good ideas, very good actions, very good things. However, what she's proposing to do is exactly the opposite of what the staffing, the budget, and the regulation over at the Department of Agriculture is doing. So you're literally in a double bind working at cross purposes. And if unless you go over to the Department of Agriculture and start to re-engineer those billions, it can do absolutely nothing. Okay, quickly, two questions and ask Catherine. The first one was, we got a question about a Roth IRA and whether or not it could be used for educational expenses. A parent wrote, and and wanted to know whether they should open a Roth IRA for a minor child who was working, and so that could help pay for the education expenses. And the reality is I have no idea, so I wrote to one of my go-to people for Roth IRAs, who is Melanie Paleo at Financial Perspectives, wonderful company in California who I love to do business with. And here's what she writes. Let me just read it to you. Yes, some custodians, what that means is not all IRA providers will do this. Some custodians do allow you to open up an IRA for a minor child so long as that minor child has earned taxable compensation, i.e. salaries, wages, tips, bonus, fees, and any other amount you've received for building a service to others. Sounds like your son has cleared this hurdle. Regarding the distribution for education expenses, you are correct. There is an exception to the 10% early withdrawal penalty for distributions made to pay for higher education expenses, which is where I assume you got the 17 to 18 age numbers, as that is around the age when college begins. The other part of the question was, could this be combined, or was it better to just invest in gold? If you go to your library for the precious metals market reports, we have one page just dedicated to the precious metals markets report. You'll see that Franklin and I covered the options to combine an IRA with investing in physical gold and silver. You can do it through Sterling Trust you can access the Delaware Depository, or you can use Entrust to access gold money. So you can combine investment with physical gold with an IRA or a Roth IRA. So it looks like that may be something you want to research further. There is an opportunity there. As you know from other Solari reports, I'm very concerned about the risks and dangers of more and more restrictions and manipulation of money in tax-managed accounts, including a Roth or an IRA. If you're pulling it out for college expenses in the not-too-distant future, seems to me like your political risk is a lot less than if you're planning on putting it in for 30 years. So second question was on UN gun rights. We got some more votes on that question, and I just wanted to mention a few things. The question was, will we have any rights at all if the UN can take our guns away? And as you know, I believe it's a well-armed population is a population that reserves or preserves a lot more rights than one that do not. Last week, I did a special on mind control technology, and it is important to understand that there are now much more invasive electronic technologies that in fact can overcome or subvert the power that guns have traditionally had. And I think it's very, very important to educate yourself about those issues so that you look at a well-armed population in a different context today than you would have 10 or 20 years ago. I also wanted to mention that I went to the Campaign for Liberty has a local chapter in Jackson, Tennessee, Tennesseans for Liberty, and went and heard a presentation by the Tennessee Firearms Association, who pointed out that gun permit holders in Tennessee are now equivalent to 50% of the population that turns out for state votes, which I thought was a very interesting statistic, and one that bodes well for what may happen in Tennessee, because that population tends to be much more sophisticated in understanding of the importance of sort of civil liberties and rights. Okay, two questions. So one other thing I wanted to mention before we go into the precious metals market report is I said that you're watching capital chase, you know, sort of bounce around the globe looking for a safe place to go. And I also get asked the question a lot about should I move here, should I move there, where can I be safe? And one of the things I try and stress is there is no away. There is no place that you can go, either your money can go or you can go, that will get away from the kind of, whether it's invasive governmental or corporate techniques or the move to centralization or the general lawlessness or the economic problems. The challenges we're facing are truly global, and they are everywhere. So there is no way. And the way to reverse the kind of spiral down in the real economy that we're watching is to look at that which is around you and try and reverse it in your own life. What you're going to see is more and more talented people with good experience and good backgrounds in your community with time on their hands. And on one hand, you can say that's unemployment. On the other hand, you can say it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to go to work and do something we could never do during the bubble, which is to turn this around. So just as we go forward, just remember there is no away. There is here. And the question is, what can you do this week here with what you've got? And truly, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. So take, look at the problem as an opportunity. Okay, precious metals market report. Franklin, are you with us?
Oh, yeah.
Well, what a week. What a week. You want to tell us about it?
Well, gold and silver entered into a correction beginning on the 2nd and 3rd of December, and they came down on the 22nd of December to lows, and then those were lows about 1085, and the gold, we'll just key off the gold. And then at the beginning of the year, they came back to the same level. So the first assumption that you have to make when you see that is, well, you've got a double bottom, that's it, that's as far as it'll go. But then they went down a lot further. Gold made a low at 1052, silver about 1485. So there was sort of this waterfall in the market. The interesting thing about it was that, you get a COMEX close at 1:30, 12:30 our time, 1:30 Eastern time, and the COMEX close on the day of that low was 1052.50, but it didn't trade there. But a very short time, and then the rest of the day it's around 1065. And from that point, it has moved up. So you have to look at that and say, maybe that's just a spike bottom. It looks something like the kind of reversal we call a key reversal, where you break to a new low, but you don't stay there. You close higher on the day and then advance after that. So whether this is over or not, whether this whole correction is over or not, it's certainly over for a while. If you had any doubt of that, then today would banish all those doubts, because gold rose through the 1075 resistance area, through the 1085 resistance area, and closed about 1095 today. So we're looking at 2 points now to climb. What we did today was climb back up inside the trend channel. We climbed up over the uptrend line, which gold had fallen through. And so we need to close over 1,100, which will sort of confirm that. And then the real point that we have to pass is the last high at 1020. Once gold gets through that, then it will be obvious that it's, that it's going farther.
At 1120 or 1020?
1120. And, I think people misunderstand what I say often, because when you look at the world, you say, well, it can go one way or it can go another way, and you can't know in advance which it's going to do. You just try to play the likelihoods, the possibilities. And in the case of gold, I can look at it and say, well, oftentimes markets will go back to a line that's equal to the apex of a triangle they broke out of. Well, that's 970 for gold. Could gold still go down there? Yes, certainly it could. But if you see gold go above 1100 and then in a few days go up above 1120, then it's heading, it's the rally has begun again. And I have thought all along, and I still think, that what we saw in the correction that began on December the 2nd was not a major correction but an intermediate correction. But more than dealing with that, that's sort of where we are right now. That's the short-term outlook. More than that, before I go on, let me talk about the dollar. The dollar went up and rallied to, about 80.50, and since then it's come down and can't get up off the ground. That doesn't mean that it's finished. It could go farther, but for right now, the dollar is hanging on a cliff. Just like gold is hanging on a cliff, is it going to turn around and go back up, or is it going to go farther down? The dollar is in the same position, because the dollar could easily turn around and go back to its, you know, to its previous lows at 74.5 or at 70.5.
Right.
I mean, you can see that.
Well, so, it's amazing that the dollar rallied right after we announced the biggest deficit we've ever had. I mean, when you go to the U.S. debt clock and you look at the contingent liabilities, they're about four times per citizen what the current debt is. But what's happening in the deficit is now with the boomers aging, that contingent liability is come, you know, every year it's creeping into the budget.
Yeah.
And the deficits are skyrocketing. And so if you look at how much the, you know, we have to borrow this year or monetize, it's an extraordinary amount of money. So the idea that the dollar's rallying at the same time shows you the advantage of having a great military.
But it also shows you that markets, just like hemlines and the
go
kind
up
of
and down.
And the kind of pants you wear, go up and down. They change. They, you know, it's nothing but fads, because the dollar was not any better on January 15th than it is today, but it was considerably lower. The euro's not any worse, but it's considerably lower. What's the difference?
Well, but there's a real effort to kind of bust. You know, if you look at what the speculators are doing in Greece and with, you know, the pigs, the Portugal, Ireland, Greece, et cetera, I mean, there's a real hit on the European debt issues and that and the stability of the euro, and that really is going on, and the hit's not going on here yet.
Well, you know, where the corpse is, the vultures will gather, and
right.
that's what you're seeing. But the fact is, all of those problems have already been there. They just came to the forefront, and what you see is the herd, so to speak, suddenly panicking and saying, oh my goodness, I better get into dollars all of a sudden.
You know, the states really are lucky that the municipal bond market is a lot less liquid when you think about it. It's harder for the speculators to play their games in the municipal market.
Right, but I don't, you know, I'm stepping around the issue that I don't think the speculators are the ones to blame.
Right.
The people who are to blame are the ones who kill the body to gather
right.
the vultures in the first place, and that's the Greek politicians, the Irish politicians, the American politicians, the central banks that have allowed this to happen.
Right.
And they've caused it. Their policies and the institutional structures caused it. So, you know, speculators, well, yeah, they're a little gamey, I'll admit, but still, they're doing nothing more than, you know, than coyotes and wolves all and hyenas always do.
As a former regulator, I just have to say in their defense, the crowd always votes for the guy who hands out more money, you know, and borrows more to do it.
Yeah. Well, really, I think we owe speculators a vote of thanks. think about that. Think about if you didn't
right,
have
they're the only one who are occasionally defending right behavior.
That's exactly right. When they go in and they close in for the kill for you know, Greek government economic sins, they're doing all of us a favor, and the Greeks too, as a matter of fact. But I'd like to turn to the longer term issue in gold and silver, because we've had a fairly severe correction, not nearly what we had in 2008, but we've had a fairly severe correction, and I've actually had people call me who were just completely panicked.
Right.
Oh, should I sell gold and silver? Should I sell gold and silver? And, you know, they saw one article on the Internet or two articles, or George Soros said something, as if George Soros ever said anything without being prompted to. And I'd like to address that. First thing I'd like to point out is back in the huge bull market of the 1970s, when gold went from $35 an ounce up to $850 an ounce, about a 25-fold increase, from 1974 until 1976, you had a 20-month period of correction. Gold dropped from $194 to $103.50. So you can do the math on that and figure it out. It's about a 50% correction. And it lasted, and it lasted, and it lasted. It lasted 20 months. And yet, if you do the division and figure it out, from that point in 1976 until the high in 1980, gold went from $103.50 up to $850. That's about an 8.5-fold increase. So if, even if gold does, you know, go down to $600, do the equivalent and say, you know, go falls from a $1,226 high down to $650, is it going to go to eight times $650? You know, is it going to go to $2,600? I mean, that's what that implies.
Well, on an inflation-adjusted basis, that's where its high was if you use the government statistics. If you use shadow stats, it's much higher.
Right. But and so we can actually expect, for a lot of different reasons, a higher high than that. But the point I'm trying to make is, if you were one of those people, and I was one of them,
mm-hmm.
I was one of those people who thought, oh, my gosh, I bought all this gold, I've been ruined. And then I held on, and it came back. The thing to you have to do here is go back and check your premises. Why did I buy this stuff in the first place? How did I get in this situation? What was it that convinced me to do it? Have those things changed? And what that helps to do is to clear out the static. It helps to suppress and squelch the static of short-term events. And if you go back and you say, okay, have we gotten rid of the Federal Reserve? Whoops, no, we haven't gotten rid of them. Do we have a government that intends to live within in its budget? Oops, no, we haven't got that. Do we have any changes? Have we heard any politician, government official, any Federal Reserve official in the last 24 months say anything that made any sense or promised any reform?
Well, the thing I thought was the most compelling this last week, and you have $120 trillion of liabilities and $60 trillion of wealth as a nation.
Mm.
And what Joe and the liabilities are coming due quickly with Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid versus the military budget. And Joe Stiglitz was very clear. He said it's absurd that we would default. We can just print the money. Well, if you look at the deficits and the money that's going to have to be printed, it's pretty clear where that goes. And so, you know, to me, if you want to go to cash, how do you go to cash without being in something that is either being printed or in one of the currencies that are being forced to print to match what the dollar is doing? Because the all fiat currencies are monetizing at incredible rates globally. It's not just, and the world's dividing into people who can print money and people who can't.
Right. People who have something that has real value and people who don't.
Right. And so if you can't print money, how do you protect yourself? Because the other guys are going to steal it through inflation.
Right. And the only way you can protect yourself is to go into an alternative currency like silver or gold, or to have some sort of undertaking, some sort of enterprise that generates, even in the depth of a depression, a stream of revenue, something you can live off of. But I'd like to go back to Stiglitz. You know, it's interesting. A policeman will tell you that criminals always confess. they want to confess. They have a desire to confess. They must bare their souls. And this guy Stiglitz said that statement that he made is exactly the same thing that Beardsley Rummel, chairman then of the Federal Reserve of New York, confessed before the American Bar Association in a speech. Basically what he said was, now that we print an unbacked currency, we're free of the tyranny of the bond market. The government can print as much money as it wants to. It can never go bankrupt.
Right.
Greenspan said something to the same effect. Now, the point I'm trying to make is, these people speak the truths of the milieu that they live in,
right,
and that they've grown up in, the people that they work around. And so this criminal is confessing to you what they believe and what they will do. They will act on those beliefs. So I think Stiglitz's statement is just another reason in a long list of reasons that we should stay with gold and silver. One other thing I'd like to mention is, you know, gold went down, it broke its long-term, it broke its uptrend line from that rose from the 8th of November of 2008, and now it's gotten back up inside that line. But if you had a chart of the entire bull market from 2001, and that I gave you that chart tonight,
right,
you'll see that there are about eight times where gold has done that.
It's just dipped a tiny little bit below the line,
right?
And yeah,
and even a large bit below the line last in fall of 2008. The difference between a bubble and a correction in a long-term bull market is that the bubble doesn't come back. The bubble does not come back.
I think we really, having lived through this last bubble, people are really struggling with how do I tell the difference between a bubble and a bull market. And to me, a bubble is when, if you look at the stock market, we saw stocks clearly trade significantly above their ability to generate income to justify that price on any kind of a present value basis. And, so when you look at the long-term usefulness of that commodity or enterprise, there is a way to tell. And with precious metals, I think you have to look not at gold or silver, because you and I would always prefer to invest in an active enterprise than to buy metal that sits in a vault and takes expenses to do that. Our problem now in investing in a lot of enterprises other than our own or those close by is we're talking about a deterioration in lawfulness. And so the question is really the dollar and the dollar's fall, and can you trust being in the dollar? And then if you can't be in the dollar or another fiat currency, where do you go? And so my feeling about a bull market in gold is you look at the debt clock, you look at the contingent liabilities, you look at where the world is going, and you say, do I expect politics to stabilize anytime soon, for lawfulness to increase anytime soon, or do I expect the monetary authorities to stop printing currency soon? And the answer is, if you look at the fundamentals, not a chance.
No, nothing's changed.
Right.
Right. Well, you made a point this evening over supper that I think answers that too, and that is, how will we know when it's time to get out of gold and silver? Well, very simply, the situation will have stabilized.
Right.
There will be a return of some kind of sound currency, some sort of monetary stability, some sort of political stability where people go back to work. I don't know if that won't require some sort of major collapse to force the end of government control of the economy, but it certainly isn't yet.
Right.
And
now, I do think, because I lived through 89 and the mark-to-market that occurred to 89, mm-hmm. and in 2008, we did not mark-to-market on the equity side. Mm-hmm. We kept the equity markets pumped up, and we poured $12 trillion into the banking system here and more abroad. And so, so we haven't mark-to-market. And I think one of the things that has everybody so skittish in the equity markets is they know 2008 could happen again. And so I think, we all have to be prepared to live through that again.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. We can see another one of those big big V spikes toward the ground again in the gold and silver market. You can see another one of those, and there certainly is one of those coming regardless of whether there's a banking and liquidity crisis or not in the stock market.
Right.
Stocks are headed way a lot further down. But what you have to do is you have to keep your eyes on the long term. Once you build a position in a bull market, you can't trade that position.
Well, that was one of our questions. How do I trade? Can I sell on the high and buy on the low?
Mm-hmm. You got to be a lot smarter than anybody I know.
It's kind of like, can you beat the house in Las Vegas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, some few people know how to count and then they get thrown out, just like the Hunts did. But, reminds me, I think I told this earlier, when the real estate market was going crazy in New York, my husband came home and he said, oh, my God, we can get so much money for a co-op, let's sell. And I looked at him and I said, where would we go? He said, oh, right. Well, I'm very resistant to trying to trade the market only because I have real problems selling something real and putting my money into the thing that's financing my enemy to buy what I just sold. So in other words, I go from a model where I'm owning and controlling real things to I'm financing somebody who is acting contradictory to my interest to buy and control that real thing.
Well, I think there's what I think is a very invidious concept going on here, and that's the whole idea of opportunity costs. At the end of the year, you can look back and say, well, I could have invested in dollars, I could have invested in bonds, stocks, gold, silver, what would my return have been? And so if you found that there was some esoteric thing like palladium or platinum that you could have invested in and it would have made more money, then you had a theoretical opportunity cost because you stayed in something else instead of that. Well, you know, that's pie in the sky. The fact is, I can't both go to McDonald's and Burger King
right.
at the same time. One hamburger is enough. It's all I can manage. And most people are not willing, and I don't blame them a bit, to sit and watch markets every day, even if they could develop the skills necessary to know when to sell and when to buy.
And one of the questions we got, which I think is a very good one, is do we pay off the mortgage or buy gold?
Okay, and you caught me on this one. You caught me because I went to the fundamental monetary question, which is where do I think that gold will be versus dollars a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now? And you pointed out, oh, no, it's much more important that you consider what a person's carrying capacity is.
Right.
What are their circumstances? And if someone has a job and they're vulnerable to being laid off and they don't have any other stream of income, well, they'd be better off to cut their debt load.
Right.
Right.
And the other thing is your home is not an investment. It's your home base.
Right.
So, and there are so many investments you can make to permanently lower your overhead or increase your health by having, you know, the right kind of home base. And that takes time to configure. And so the cost of losing your house is much greater than an investment cost. It's a cost of health and lots of other issues.
Well, there's another issue, too, and that is the vulnerability of debt.
Right.
You know, I understand that this runs contrary to what all of us have been taught, but the fact is that debt makes you vulnerable.
Right.
It makes you easy to break.
Right. You're like grease. You can get squeezed. And no, but people, when they see that weakness, they'll squeeze you.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and it enters into all other parts of your life. A quick question. I suggested that states need a currency, but the Constitution says states can only make silver or gold coin. Are you suggesting states can issue credits? So maybe if you could say a few words about the Constitution and states.
The limitation on states is that they can declare a legal tender, but only gold or silver coin. That's it, nothing else. And this is a principle well tested in the 1820s and 30s in a number of famous court cases. And the Supreme Court held that states cannot issue their own money. It did not hold that states cannot declare a tender, but rather that they can't issue their own paper money, even if they do it through a state bank. So that's not an option. But, you know, there's a bill that surfaced in the that right now is in the South Carolina legislature, which would do exactly that. The state would declare that only gold and silver coin are a tender, and it provides all the mechanisms to do just exactly that. The state would publish every day what the basic coin would be, the dollar of silver. And then the state would publish every day what the gold-silver ratio is so that prices could be adjusted. And it's a fabulous bill. It's a perfect bill. Will it pass? I doubt it. Not yet, but it will.
Well, the states are going to have to grapple with the currency issue because they're when they go through the budget balancing this summer, they're going to have to deal with being up against a power that can issue currency. And as part of that, they're going to have to they're going to have to grapple with both deposits, reserves, pension funds. Their states are shipping a huge amount of capital to Wall Street, and and they're going to have to face accountability on that because how are they going to grapple with huge unemployment if they're shipping literally all their capital to Wall Street, and Wall Street is using that capital to engineer the jobs abroad.
Right.
So the states are literally financing their own destruction, and the states are going to face the same question as China is facing with its sovereign wealth fund. Do we really want to finance our competitors?
Right. I think that will come. We saw a bill like that in Georgia last year. This one has come up in South Carolina, a much better bill. And as the states find increasingly their backs are up against the wall, their people are without employment, they're going to look for solutions, and you're right. They're going to pull that capital and bring it home, and they're going to figure out, hey, we need a currency that will build our economy instead of tear it down.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, time for state banks, too. Okay, now a little bugaboo of mine. We had a great Solari report earlier. Again, you can all find it at the Precious Metals Library for subscribers, about how that if you add up all the gold in the world, the ETFs can't possibly have the gold they say they do. And one of the things Franklin and I were talking about today was if you look at the funds that people believe are fully collateralized with the gold, they're trading at premiums of 8% plus, whereas GLD and SLV, which are two of the gold, the largest gold and the silver ETFs, are trading at a negative premium. They're trading at a discount. So clearly the market doesn't believe that all the gold and silver is there. Anyway, so I wanted to just mention a few things about the ETFs. I started to dig in, and there are serious short positions in the silver market, and one of the criticisms during the January fall was there were indications that the ETFs, both GLD and SLV, sold a tremendous amount of tonnage on the market. And the question were these sales being used to depress the market, particularly the paper market? And so I dug in and realized that the biggest short in the silver market by a huge amount is J.P. Morgan Chase, who is also the custodian for the silver for SLV, which strikes me as an enormous and terrifying conflict of interest. So I dug in and looked at the prospectuses, and in the risk section, Franklin, I want you to know there's absolutely no disclosure of the fact that SLV's custodian has the biggest short in the market. Now, let me just explain what this means. What this means is your custodian, you put money in SLV, your custodian has a vested interest in driving the price of your shares down, but that's not disclosed. That's what I call a material omission.
Right.
Now, also reported, Franklin, was the fact that the Mint, the U.S. Mint, not only had its best year last year, but it had its best month in January. So we're seeing, and you're dealing with physical flows, how was the physical market in January?
It was a little slower, but not a lot. And one of the things is I publish a daily commentary, and so there are times that I tell people, wait to buy. And so that, you know, I'm sure that slows things down, but it hasn't been a much lower volume than we've seen all along. So, and I think that the difference you pointed out between, say, Central Fund of Canada, which actually has the physicals, and everybody knows they have the physicals, and SLV is the same thing that we see in the physical market, where people are willing to pay big premiums for physical gold and silver and undergo the additional cost of having to deal with it, you know, physically handle it themselves. That's a backwardation. We saw it in 2008, when premiums on gold and silver items went to 20 and 40%. Well, the paper, in other words, they were 20 to 40% higher than the paper price.
Right.
So
right.
What you're seeing is that the demand for physicals is so great that even when the paper price goes down, people are willing to pay basically the same price or higher prices than they have been paying for physical gold and silver so they can get their hands on it.
Well, it's funny. For every call I got of people worried that it was dropping, I got two calls of people saying, should I buy now or wait, and will it drop more? Because this is a great buying opportunity. Okay. Well, Franklin, thank you so much. We'll be back next month for more. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, in closing, I just want to let you know next week we're going to have George Norrie, the host of Coast to Coast, to talk about what it's like to host a radio show where you get to explore every possible subject that everyone else is afraid to talk to or not allowed to talk about. And we're also going to discuss George's new book, Journey to the Light, Find Your Spiritual Self and Enter into a World of Infinite Opportunity. And as backup, because George has a very unpredictable schedule, as backup, if for any reason George has to cancel, I'm finally going to get a chance to answer what is now one of the top voted questions that I asked Catherine. I'm an introvert. What can I possibly do you know, to help the world and navigate this environment that doesn't involve, you know, a lot of personal contact with strangers. Anyway, so it's a great question. What do introverts do at a time like this? Then the first week in March, a wonderful permaculturalist is going to be joining us for From Permaculture to Profits, which I think is going to be a very important conversation. I am seeing all over the country tremendous interest as we see more and more volatility in the stock market, more and more lawlessness and dirty tricks. Private equity and local investment is becoming more and more attractive because despite all the challenges and problems, you know, they're beginning to diminish in terms of degree of difficulty when you look at sort of what's going on in the public markets. Paul Ferguson, who's the treasurer of my Solari Circle, the first ever Solari Circle, wrote a little piece on the blog, which I really recommend to you, called Investing in Startup Companies. And he talks about some of the issues and how it relates to what's going on in the public market. But the permaculturalist we're going to have on in the beginning of March is somebody who's been very successful at helping in an urban and suburban environment, starting food operations and food businesses. And I think there's more and more interest in the country as land becomes available, as people are unemployed. How do we go to work doing something in our local area which is economically sound, can create real businesses? And so Eric just has an immense amount of experience in building sort of sustainable, financially sustainable operations using permaculture in suburban and urban environments. So I really encourage you to join us for that one as well. So I was going to talk about the 2010 census tonight, but that's because of money and markets, we didn't have time, and I will pick up on that in Money and Markets next week with George Norrie. So until next week, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.